Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, January 16, the day that we celebrate the life of Dr. Martin Luther King. And a reminder, we have a special broadcast in Madison at noon. There will be a special commemoration of his life, and we will carry that broadcast at noon today here on the Ideas Network. Clarence Page is our guest for all things political. We have a lot to talk about with him. We have spent a lot of time recently on the Republican presidential field, and John Huntsman is dropping out of the race, so we will discuss that. But Clarence wrote an interesting piece recently on how a populist Obama can win. We haven't talked about the president for some time, so we'll ask him what he's thinking about when he says that the president still has reason to hope, and he's making changes beginning with himself. What are those changes? He also wrote about Daley's dash, the reason, the real story behind White House Chief of Staff Bill Daley's abrupt departure from his job after only 1 year, because, of course, this is the day that we mark the life of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and I always listen to a lot of his old speeches on this day. What a remarkable, remarkable man he was. We will ask the question how the dream fares in 2012, and what about the issue of economic inequality, which he would have been talking a great deal about now if he were alive at the age of 83, which would not have been unheard of. He could have been had the tragedy not happened. Will this play out in the presidential year in any substantial way? And we'll have to ask him about Stephen Colbert running for president of South Carolina. And more, I'm sure. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Clarence, 1989 Pulitzer Prize winner for commentary, a columnist syndicated nationally by Tribune Media Services, and a member of the Chicago Tribune's editorial board. He's also a regular contributor to the NewsHour, to NBC's The Chris Matthews Show, ABC's Nightline, BET's Lead Story News Panel programs. He is the author of Showing My Color, Impolite Essays on Race and Identity. He was born in Dayton, Ohio, began his journalism career as a freelance writer and photographer for the Middleton Journal and Cincinnati Inquirer at the age of 17. Here's our phone number for you to join our All Things Political conversation. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Hello, Clarence.
Good morning. Happy King Day.
Thank you, and to you too, sir. Did you ever meet him?
Oh, no, I was a student when he was assassinated. In fact, I'll never forget the news coming across our student newspaper office at Ohio University. We had a machine called a teletype. Do you remember those?
Yes, I do, Clarence.
Yes, I've explained to the young people who don't even remember typewriters that a teletype was what we had before Google, and that's how the news came rolling in, you know, and that was back in 68. I've got a picture I'm looking at on my wall. The very next day, Peter, Paul, and Mary were scheduled to be on campus, and they did come. They almost canceled, but they came and did a tribute to King. And I have a picture of myself interviewing Peter Yarrow from Peter, Paul, and Mary. With both of us have very long sideburns.
Well, let's talk about King for just a moment, because this whole issue of economic inequality, which he spoke about, would be so front and center in whatever he had to say to us at the age of 83 today had he lived, don't you think?
Oh, no question about it. You know, he, after the Civil Rights Act of 64 and the Voting Rights Act of 65 were passed, and of course the National, even before the National Housing Act of 67, although he was instrumental, you know, he'd already turned his movement toward economic inequality and economic justice, and had a confrontation with Mayor Daley in Chicago over housing issues and the campaign to end slums. He moved into a tenement on the west side of Chicago, and that was the one time, to make a very long story short, but for those who are students of King's history, and you know, you look at the wonderful books written by Taylor Branch and others.
Yes.
That was the one time that King failed. Daley hoodwinked him, finally made a deal, signed a housing covenant, which as soon as King left town, Daley promptly reneged on. But, you know, and of course, King was assassinated while campaigning for the sanitation workers in Memphis. There's no question that what was interesting to me is that, after the civil rights bills were passed in 64 and 65, and King turned to causes like fighting poverty and, of course, opposing the war in Vietnam, another famous speech. Then we started seeing people in the North turn against him. You know, it was like when he was talking about race, it seemed like a Southern thing. He got full support from Mayor Daley and other Northerners, but a lot of folks started turning against him, like the old church joke about the preacher preaching the Ten Commandments, and he got to thou shalt not commit adultery, and a deacon walked out saying, "Now you done stop preaching and gone to meddling." Americans are not comfortable with race, but we're even less comfortable with class, and I think we're seeing that in today's presidential race.
Paul Krugman, I'm sure you saw his column this morning, wrote about "Goodbye Jim Crow, Hello Class System."
I've been saying this for years, and I'm not alone. It's just, especially for those of us who lived through the '60s, it's very obvious that that you started seeing a turn of the civil rights movement. And of, really liberal politics in general toward fighting poverty. You know, Lyndon Johnson had his war on poverty, and Ronald Reagan in 1980 threw down, drew a line in the sand saying that we fought poverty and poverty won, that was his way of trying to pull government out of the business of trying to fight poverty. So that debate definitely goes on today with the Tea Party on one side and Occupy Wall Street on the other.
I was interested in a piece that you wrote on January 4 in which, I don't know, maybe President Obama has been listening a lot to King's speeches, but you talk about his toughening up. We've got a new feisty, rolled-up, shirt-sleeves populism erupting in his politics since September. Is this going to fare him well, and is this who he really is? What's it all about?
Number one, as far as faring well, his polling has already turned around. His numbers were slipping all summer. And then in September and October, as he began to take a more forceful stance and more populist rhetoric, even channeling Teddy Roosevelt out in this highly celebrated Kansas speech, you saw his opinion polls begin to turn around and come back up. They're close to 50-50 now. Had been slipping down. And I think what makes the difference here is that whether you're on the right or the left, people want some political leader who's going to speak forcefully on their behalf, who they feel is on their side and is not just going to be soft about it. It's going to, especially when they're getting slapped in the face, which is the kind of narrative we've seen unfold in Washington over the past couple of years, that the Republicans have been quite staunch forceful in their opposition to Obama, fueled by Tea Party outrage. Here we see Occupy Wall Street rising up on the other end, symbolizing the discontent on the left. The departure of Bill Daley, chief of staff that you mentioned earlier, here a couple of weeks ago shows that Bill Daley was more of the conciliatory outreach guy. That was why he was brought in, to reach out to Wall Street and to Congress. As we've seen over the last year, it didn't work. Obama's criticism from Wall Street has continued. He hasn't gotten a lot of cooperation there, and of course Congress, he's gotten no cooperation, a lot of opposition. So I think that Daley's departure was indicative of Obama setting a tone for this next campaign year.
Yeah. Does he run a risk of not having spoken out on a lot of these issues earlier? There is, as you know, a general perception that nobody's speaking on behalf of the people who are out of work or have seen their paychecks go down, or people who are really experiencing this huge disparity in income in this country. Can the president capture that? Has he got enough time to do that?
Well, I think so. My experience covering politics off and on since I was a student back in King's day is that the American public has remarkably short memories about these things. For one thing, they want to know, what have you done for me lately? it's remarkable how quickly they can turn around. In fact, in 1992, Bob Teeter, who was the first President Bush's chief political advisor, said that any change in the economy to have an effect on the November election must occur by Labor Day. That it takes a couple of months for any economic shift, one way or the other, to show up in the polls as a reaction in public opinion. So I think that you can see this already. The Obama campaign has not really raised its profile much. These Obama speeches lately have been kind of testing the waters. And the fact that the forceful approach is having a positive impact tells me that over the summer we're going to start seeing more of this barnstorming by the president in the style of Harry Truman back in 48.
And how are the Republicans? It looks as though, I don't know, maybe we'll all be surprised by South Carolina, but it does look as though increasingly it's going to be Mitt Romney.
Yep.
What will be their, they couldn't have more opposite ideas about things if that's the way Obama goes. What will Romney's plan be?
They could have more opposite ideas. Sarah Palin could get the nomination, right?
That's true.
Romney's really a moderate. This is why there's such a fierce anybody but Mitt movement that's been going on among the Republicans, but I think they'll accept him. You know, President Bill Clinton has always said Democrats would need to fall in love, Republicans fall in line.
Mm-hmm.
This is the way these campaigns tend to work. That Republicans traditionally they may have a fierce debate during the primaries, but once an apparent front runner arises, they fall behind them. So I think that's probably what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about Stephen Colbert? Is Huntsman getting out today because Colbert was polling ahead of him in South Carolina?
Well, you know, I think, with Stephen Colbert, I don't know if you saw his program last week.
Yeah, I did.
Well, you know, I thought he gave a brilliant satirical commentary on this whole super PAC system. That's really what this is about, I think. It was a brilliant commentary because most people don't understand this super PAC system. It was invented as a reform, an attempt to make our campaigns more honest and fair. And as usual, the rules themselves have these gaping loopholes that make a travesty of the whole thing. And he, just simply by talking with his lawyer there on the show, on the air about these rules, and establishing John Stewart, who everybody knows is a good friend of his, as the guy going to run the super PAC. And the law says you cannot coordinate. What does that mean?
I know.
You know,
it's ridiculous.
That's the thing.
Right.
And this is why it's so absurd, because as he said, you know, Rick Perry, Newt Gingrich, and others have got these super PACs. They're supposed to be uncoordinated, but they're run by people who used to work for them. And this is, I guess, really what this is about. But it's interesting that the poll the opinion poll in South Carolina showed like 9% already want Stephen Colbert for the Republican nominee, even though he had not declared yet, or he has not declared. He's got certainly a lot of popularity and credibility. But I think the main thing here is, you know, to highlight the absurdity of this super PAC system.
It's going to be nothing but TV ads, isn't it? All there will be.
Well, you know, it's been slowly becoming that ever since 1960. I was reminiscing with one of our young interns, a couple of our young interns the other day, who, of course, loved to hear me talk about the old days, like all young people do. But they were actually quite fascinated, though, because these are media students. And I was just talking about how, you know, when I was 12 years old, watching the Nixon-Kennedy debates on TV, the very first one coming on after the Ed Sullivan Show, from the studios of WBBM-TV in Chicago, which years later I would work for and work in those same studios. But little did we know at the time that TV was going to replace, just displace and replace the traditional system of precinct captains and ward bosses that American party politics had run on for decades. And that's what we have seen now. You've got the air wars, they say, which is TV and radio ads. You've got the ground war, which is direct mail, which is still important. But both direct mail and the door-to-door campaigning. TV is getting a bigger and bigger role. But as we've seen on a number of occasions in the past, just because you've got more money and can put more ads on the air doesn't necessarily mean you're going to win, but it does give you an edge.
Clarence Page is our guest for All Things Political today, op-ed columnist, Tribune Media Services, member of the editorial board for the Chicago Tribune, and analyst you see frequently on television, all kinds of networks, many, many times. We're talking about presidential politics. We're on this day that we mark the life of Dr. Martin Luther King, asking how fares the King dream in 2012? What about the issue of economic inequality, which he was very concerned about, and how does it play out in this year's presidential race? Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we'll start taking phone calls. Tony in Tomahawk is our first caller for you, Clarence. Hi, Tony.
Good morning, Clarence. I'm glad you're on the air, and I always appreciate listening to you. There was a story in the Milwaukee paper Friday the 13th, actually, and it was in the business section. Should have been on the front page. It talked about a hedge fund is turning up the heat on Wausau Paper Corporation. And basically what's happened is a hedge fund from New York that owns 10% of the company stock has effectively closed the mill near Wausau, Wisconsin, Brokaw, Wisconsin. 450 people are losing their jobs. The mills will be closed in March. And now the company is demanding that hedge fund is demanding that the company break up into pieces the rest of the company or be sold outright. This is just the height of vulture capitalism. And I think it's a story that if you can get involved with this, you could do something to change history and not just talk about it. It's an amazing story. It really is a microcosm of what's gone on in this country for the last 30 years, and it desperately needs national attention.
Well, you've certainly raised a very good point, and you're right. It is a national story because it's happening all over the country in a lot of different instances. And as part of this current debate that's broken out during the campaign over what kind of venture capitalist was Mitt Romney at Bain Capital, we didn't hear complaints about companies like Bain back in the 90s during the economic prosperity, the boom years. But in recent years, as the economy has gone bust, we're seeing stress sales like what you're talking about there with this one particular company and quite a few other companies, too. And a debate over whether or not Mitt Romney really created jobs or didn't. And he kind of started this by saying, you know, he created more than 100,000 jobs. He has now rolled back on that number. He did not talk about what jobs were lost during these takeovers of various companies. No question that he helped bring back companies like Sports Authority and there was a couple of other big names like that that were helped out by Bain Capital. But there are others like KB Toys that went under. It wasn't necessarily Bain's fault that they went under. You know, KB Toys was located in shopping malls at a time when the toy business was moving to other locations. And you've got those kind of trends that were happening. But this is basically how capitalism works and how it has worked in America in recent years. But I think Romney's big mistake was in claiming to be a job creator, which I can't blame him for thinking about that, because that's what the argument on Capitol Hill has been for the last couple of years, that you don't want to hurt the job creators by having higher tax rates on the wealthier or on corporations. But this is the result of it. Are they really creating jobs or not? And a closer look shows that most of the folks in those upper income brackets aren't earning their money off of job creation, but they're earning it off of dividends and investments like what Bain Capital was engaged in. And there's only one obligation. Milton Friedman said there's only one moral obligation a corporation has, and that's to making a profit. It's not to creating jobs. So I think, you know, we're starting to see a closer look at how these sort of operations really work.
What's the story on the documentary that Gingrich put together in South Carolina, the mini documentary? I was reading yesterday that he told the Romney campaign, listen, if it's got inaccuracies, let me know what they are and I'll correct them. Is it filled with inaccuracies? Do you know?
Well, I think the documentary you're talking about was actually created by a super PAC.
Right, I'm sorry. Got those mixed up. They don't have any association
no
with each other,
coordination,
right?
Coordination, that's
exactly. Right, forgot.
And, when Gingrich was questioned about this, you know, he said he was calling on the super PAC to change, fix the inaccuracies or take it down, stop promoting it. So I'm not sure about the details of what's happened since then. How much they have changed, if any, but that does show you what can happen in these kind of instances where you have this has happened with Romney here earlier. There was another ad that was being put up either by Romney or on behalf of his campaign, which had an inaccurate quote in it. And it was a quote out of context, but Romney stood by it. An Obama quote, a soundbite out of context, but Romney stood by it and refused to change it. So you can have these kind of arguments going on during a campaign as well.
Let's go. Thanks, Tony, for your call. Ken in Delta. Hi, Ken.
Hi. I'd like to hear some comments from your guest about the hypocrisy of candidates like Rick Perry, who's championing his tort reform in the state of Texas, and Wisconsin's recently done some tort reform also, but putting limits on the amounts that a judge and jury can award people that have been wronged by some of these corporations who can put unlimited money into campaigns, but yet they want to limit the free speech of a judge and a jury. How can this be? And I'll take my comments off the air.
All right, thanks, Ken.
Yeah, I share your outrage. From my understanding, Texas tort reform law limits the amount that one can sue, in medical malpractice. I think it's $300,000. I'm not sure exactly, but he's right, though. It does seem contradictory that you can have a state law that puts a limit on how much an ordinary person can sue for damages while saying that corporations have no limit on their on the money they can spend in campaigns because of free speech. But this is where we are right now with the Supreme Court, as conservative as it is, and as pro-corporate as it is, their decisions have been leaning in favor of money and speech being the same. I had a friend of mine the other day who said, if that's true, can a corporation be drafted? Can a corporation vote? No, a corporation can't vote, but the people who work for a corporation can contribute money through the corporation and have an influence on a campaign and a lot of other people's votes. But this is why we have elections. The voters, both at the state level and the federal level, have to vote to decide what kind of government they want to have.
Let's go back to this, whether or not Romney is a job creator, the number of people who lost their jobs under Bain Capital. You hear again and again from voters when you look at these news reports from people in South Carolina and elsewhere, well, I really want a businessman to run the country. We've got tough economic times. Somebody who ran a business is going to be much more able to get us out of our economic doldrums. Why do people go that way? And will there be in this election a real substantive conversation about the nature of free enterprise and capitalism and the nature of capitalism in 2012?
Well, that's a very good question. You know, this comes up from time to time. I remember writing about this back in 92 when Ross Perot rose up as a folk hero. You remember those days?
Sure.
And there was this, you know, people saying, yeah, I want government to run like a business. And my response is always, no, you don't. because a business is motivated by profit. That's the job of a corporation. As I mentioned, paraphrasing Milton Friedman, that in fact, a corporation has a fiduciary obligation to put profit above everything else. If you're a stockholder and your corporation is sacrificing some profits on behalf of some sort of a human rights cause or whatever, you have the right to sue that corporation and perhaps sue the board, sue the leaders of the corporation and all for neglecting their fiduciary obligation. Government, on the other hand, we elect government for the purpose of public service, not for making a profit. So the entire incentive system is different, and people need to ask themselves up front, do you really want that kind of incentive system in your government, or people who are nurtured on that kind of a system? So it's a fair question. We do have a mythologization of business folks in America. Certainly Steve Jobs is the latest example of it, someone who just about everybody admires. I mean, Steve Jobs has changed my life. I became,
sure.
I was in a mixed marriage. I was PC. My wife was Apple. And after, I look around now, you know, the iPhone, I got my iPad, got my MacBook, you know. Yeah, we love Steve Jobs because his narrative fits that classic American Horatio Alger and innovator, et cetera, like Henry Ford, et cetera, et cetera. But the fact is that you've also got what the vulture capitalist, a term that Rick Perry brought up and was slapped down by fellow Republicans saying, you're sounding like Obama and those other socialists. You know, indeed, he was crossing narratives there. You know, he was Rick Perry. He used to be a Democrat. Moments like that, you could tell. You know, his populist streak came up, and he started knocking the Wall Street types for getting what party he's in now. It's a fair question because people are frustrated, and understandably, I'm frustrated at the inefficiencies of the economy in recent years. The gridlock in Washington, the polarized politics, et cetera. I understand why people say, well, maybe we need a businessman or a businesswoman to get in there and do it. But in fact, businessmen and businesswomen have not had a lot of great luck in politics in recent years. I'm thinking of Carly Fiorina out in California and various others around the country. They have not had great luck. They're two different worlds. And I think too often we just in general want a simple solution and in this case think, well, a business person, that's what we need. That's going to solve the problem. It's not necessarily true.
Clarence Page, our guest, it's All Things Political for this Monday, the day that we mark the life of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And hour number two, we'll talk about service. What have I done to make someone's life better? A big theme of his life as well. So that will be hour two of our show. Our number is 800-486-8655. And our email address is talk@wpr.org. Jim in Milwaukee is next. Hi, Jim.
Hi.
Hi.
I enjoy Mr. Page's work in the Trib. I read it frequently. What I wanted to talk about today is that it's kind of a contradiction because we have such great, many of us have such great admiration for Dr. King. In the book The Hidden Brain by Shankar Vedantam, V-E-D-A-N-T-A-M, you can Google it on the net. It talks
I know Shankar. It's a very good book, by the way.
Yes. And he talks that Dr. King put people on the path of righteous indignation, but that the problem was that calling people out on racism made them defensive, and that even if you won the argument, you could lose their vote. And specifically, to give people reference, pages 223 and 224 in that general area of the book are really excellent because they talk about that if you confront people on a conscious level, it actually strengthens their feeling because they deny the fact, the quote, facts that you present to them. And so that you have to try to reach them on an unconscious level, start out validating their feelings, their feelings of being ill at ease about whatever issue it happens to be, and then reach them on a subconscious level where they're not being corrected, they're being courageous for affecting a change. And because you can't, in the traditional terms that we like to think about, work with logic on the people. They just bat it right back at you. And so To understand this and to develop techniques to get through is something that's imperative to me. One final point that I'll make is that in addition to validating their views and trying to work your commercials in ways that accept their uncertainty about things, I think also maybe humor has some utility as well. For example, I'm 71. I've been married for 45 years. And this idea that Santorum has that, if you had gay marriages, that somehow this would threaten my marriage and it might lead to all sorts of sexual abnormalities. And you know, I see it as ridiculous. And so one way I might satirize it is to say that if I believed Santorum, then I, as a Democrat, might someday relinquish my 45-year marriage because I fell in love with a donkey. And then at the wedding ceremony, the pastor would be saying, "Let us bray." And other Democrats who married donkeys would be having a bray pride parade. And, you know, and so you can take it on to the point of the ridiculous. But it is ridiculous, and yet because of this defensiveness and this fearfulness of change, a lot of older people will accept this kind of con manipulation and be diverted off of the real realities, which are the decline of the middle class in our society.
Clarence.
Yeah, I like that, by the way. Let us pray. Make a nice bumper sticker. What you say is true. If you really want to reach people politically, you've got to hit them on the non-political level. You've got to hit them at the emotional level and or the gut level, as a Republican consultant I know often says. This is how politics really can reach out, is emotionally. One person who was a master of this was Bill Clinton, whose approval ratings keep getting higher and higher because we always love people we can't have anymore. And he had terrific outreach into the more conservative, southern, rural, small-town America because he came from it and he spoke its language and connected on an emotional level with them. President Barack Obama, as a candidate, was urged by a number of people not to run because he was thinking about running for the U.S. Senate right after 9/11, when Osama bin Laden's face was on the cover of Time magazine, and David Axelrod, who used to be an intern under my supervision, as you may recall. Back
no,
in the
I
70s.
Don't remember that, really.
I always love to drop that in conversations.
Uh-huh.
Brilliant young man. But David, at the time, Obama was trying to talk him into running his campaign, and David held up his Time magazine and said, "This isn't very good for you, you know." The fact, you know, the very notion that we were going to elect a president who's not only half black, but has an Arab sounding name that sounds like the number one terrorist
in
the world. You know, all of this worked against Barack Obama, but he found ways to connect emotionally with the public that put him over the top. And I have to say, I've written this, you know, I was disappointed with his inaugural speech and a number of the other speeches afterwards, that he got more technocratic and less emotionally connective as he had been with his earlier campaign speeches, and that brilliant 2004 Democratic Convention speech, which was his inauguration to the national audience. And you know, this is an important element of politics, which is going to be interesting to watch, by the way, to wrap this up, over the next few months, because it looks like Romney is going to be the nominee. And to look at Romney's style and Obama's style, you know, Barack Obama has that gift that so many politicians in every party want, whether it's Bill Clinton or Ronald Reagan. They walk into a room, and everybody in that room immediately feels like, that, isn't that wonderful? He came here just for me.
Right,
you know?
Right.
You know, there are certain Pauls who've got that ability, and Romney is known for not having that ability, for not having that kind of charisma. And it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out as he tries desperately hard to be warm and to project it, to see how well it works.
Did you read, you have to read it if you haven't, Calvin Trillin's piece in The New Yorker on Mitt Romney this week, Clarence?
It's, oh, I have not.
It's very funny.
Thank you. I've got to look for that.
Yeah, it's very funny.
I know Bud Trillin, I'm happy and proud to say. And speaking of using humor, he's just brilliant.
Yes, he was. This piece is brilliant, and he could do it for a Democrat too, and probably will. But it's very, very funny. Mm-hmm. All right, Jim. Thanks so much for the call. Let's go to Sam in Madison. Hi, Sam.
Good morning, Kathleen, and good morning, Terrence.
Morning.
Thank you for taking my call. I have two comments, and I would like to see what Terrence could say about that. I think that the two primaries that have been held so far, in which Mitt Romney won, and media talked about it, but I thought the biggest story was actually Ron Paul. And I just want to clarify that I'm not a Ron Paul supporter. I'm not even a U.S. citizen. I can't vote. And the reason is that Ron Paul went against the strong military-industrial complex and big corporations and was also largely ignored by media. I mean, now the media is talking about it because he's done well. He still did really well with the election in the primaries. And the second comment I want to make is that I think Barack Obama would really hate to go against Ron Paul in the presidential campaigns because Ron Paul is appealing to the same young voters that Barack Obama appealed to and actually got elected.
Yeah.
So, and I would love to see a debate between Barack Obama and Ron Paul because this will be the first time two intelligent people who will talk about, I think, issues that people like to hear about. And I'm just wondering what your guess has been.
Ron Paul is a big story, Clarence, isn't he?
Oh, yeah. And I thank your caller for calling. He is a big story, and this is his third time running for president, and his other two times. I was amazed, personally, when I first wrote about Ron Paul, I was not being terribly complimentary because my political agenda is not like his. I was amazed at the outpouring of emails I got from Ron Paul supporters who were thanking me, not for what I said about him, but just thanking me for mentioning him. Because they were so firmly convinced that the media were deliberately freezing Ron Paul out of public discussion. This still goes on, there's not a conspiracy to freeze him out. The fact is Ron Paul has a ceiling of appeal around 20%. He has been able to expand on that. These days, because this is his third time running, a lot of people who are not regular Republicans are participating now, being drawn in, and we're in the internet Twitter age now. And social networking really helps pull out a lot of those young people he's talking about. But I disagree that Paul is reaching out to the same young people that Obama reached. I know my own son and his friends are a good focus group for this because. Obama got my kid off the couch 4 years ago when he was just turning 18, and he went out and campaigned door to door for Obama with much more vigor than anything I've seen him do around our house. Four years later, my son has got a more sober, pragmatic view of politics. He's disappointed that Guantanamo is still open and blah blah blah. He's learned a lot of things about the realities of politics, which is one reason why a lot of the Obama supporters aren't as excited as they were 4 years ago. But it is true that Ron Paul is getting the attention of young people, some of whom had supported Obama. But as soon as they see Ron Paul's agenda, like during the debates when he was asked, "What do you think should be done for a person without health care is dying on the street?" and he didn't say let him die like some guy in the audience did, but he did evade the question as if the community out of their own good hearts is just going to come out and take care of him. It's an old view of America that just doesn't apply today, and this is why Ron Paul tends to attract the same kids like I was back in high school when I was an Ayn Rand fan, you know? I mean,
were you,
teenager is not a libertarian, right?
Right, that's true.
Legalize drugs, legalize prostitution, in the draft. What teenager, what is there for a teen not to love? But in my view, most of us, as we grow older, we moderate our views. Ron Paul never has. He is indeed a pure, true believer. Even when his agenda directly conflicts with his own party, which is another big reason why he hasn't gotten farther and why the press has not taken him more seriously. Now, will he run as a third-party candidate? I think that's the question this year. 'Cause the time has never been better for Ron Paul to really have an impact by running as a third-party candidate. And that's something I think Mitt Romney is really up
to. Do you think he will, Clarence?
I think it's a good possibility.
Do you?
And Ron Paul loves to be unpredictable. So.
Right, yeah, he could.
So I will not rule that out. This is, he has not ruled it out. But he's not going to say outright, because while he's still running as a Republican candidate, it would be political suicide for him to say, and if I don't win this, I'm going to run as a third-party candidate.
Yeah.
I think it's a possibility, just like with Ross Perot back in 92. I'm not going to say that he's definitely going to do it. It's not easy to get on that ballot, but I have said that, you know, this Americans Elect project, which has gotten started to try to get an alternative candidate, regardless of what party, get them elected through an internet convention. I have said that Ron Paul may very well win that, because as I mentioned, I have personally experienced the kind of internet power that Ron Paul and his supporters
mm-hmm.
have. So that's a possibility. And who would be his running mate? Then that's the question.
Mm.
Politico did an Americans Elect type poll recently, and Hillary Clinton won. So I said, well, this would be interesting. How about a Ron Paul-Hillary Clinton ticket? And I want to tell you, I really got emails for that suggestion.
Bet you did. Let's go back for just a moment to your son and his friends who went door-to-door 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But they're slightly disillusioned now, but mm-hmm. probably will still vote for Obama. But will they go door-to-door? And what would it take for them to go door-to-door?
I'm still waiting to see that happen. I will say that I know the Obama campaign has already got some campus operations around the country. They're kind of below the radar screen of major media, but not the high-profile efforts that we saw 4 years ago. And Axelrod and others in the campaign have conceded that the excitement is not going to be as big this time as 4 years ago. They recognize that, because, you know, he's not the bright, shiny, new Christmas morning toy that he was
mm-hmm.
4 years ago. The realities of the world set in. And it's going to be, as they put it, as Team Obama puts it, a contrast campaign. That translates to my journalistic ears as attack ads. They're going to be on both sides. You're going to have contrast between what the Republicans offer versus what the Democrats offer. That doesn't excite young people as much as the real idealistic campaign. However, I think that you will see later on this summer some efforts to recruit young people as volunteers. That's already starting to happen. And my son, for example, he said he wasn't going to volunteer, but as he started watching the Republican debates, and started getting a little more angry. He started saying, "Yeah, I guess I will." You know, so he hasn't done it yet, but he's been moved by watching the Republicans. So I don't know. We will see what will happen with young folks, but I suspect in this era of Occupy Wall Street and Tea Party, we're going to see young people on both sides come out in slightly larger numbers. But my biggest problem with young people is that they don't come out in bigger numbers all the time. You know, under 30s, only about 30% turnout. Over age 55, it's two-thirds turnout, around 66%. So this is why we have in this country, the only industrialized country, where older people get more government support than our kids do. And I don't think that's good for America, but it's one of those realities.
Mm-hmm. Clarence Page, our All Things Political guest this hour, op-ed columnist, Tribune Media Services, member of the editorial board, Chicago Tribune, and analyst on many political national TV shows and radio shows. We're welcoming more phone calls for him. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program today. Since 1994, Martin Luther King Day has been a national day of service. We'll have two guests with us talking about the importance of national and community service, the executive director of Serve Wisconsin, and we'll also speak with the national director of AmeriCorps. Back to phone calls for Clarence Page, Carol in Grand Marsh. Hi, Carol.
Hello. Hello. Thank you for taking my call. My concern was what you were talking about, the tort reform for medical malpractice, and somebody connected that to corporations. And I'd like to correct that, because medical malpractice regards suing an individual, which is the doctor. The reason the medical malpractice was reformed in Wisconsin is so that the premiums that they'd have to pay as doctors would be reasonable for people who already have high debt, because medical malpractice costs are very high, and that therefore increases the cost that doctors have to charge to be able to make businesses in their general business areas. And that's one of the things we need, to be able to have good recruiting to the state of Wisconsin, particularly in the rural areas, to be able to recruit doctors to work in the rural areas. So that's the difference between that and what they were relating that to corporate reform. I think those are two different facts, and I agree that corporate reform needs to be done. Any comments regarding that?
Well, I appreciate the clarification. I think the only problem with tort reform, as far as medical malpractice goes, is do people really want to put a limit on it that enables corporations or doctors? Well, we're talking about the insurance companies that insure doctors, that enables them to take a certain level of acceptable risk, like the auto companies that decided not to put in certain safety features, figuring it would there was enough acceptable risk in just letting bad things happen and take the lawsuit and pay the prescribed amount. You know, that's the kind of the debate that we haven't had enough of around tort reform, because there's so much negative feeling that people can easily gin up against lawyers that it becomes an emotional issue that doesn't think down the road about the total consequences of it.
Thanks, Carol. Bill in Madison. Hi, Bill.
Hello. I guess I'd like, first of all, I'm honored to be on the same airways with Mr. Page. It's great privilege.
My feeling is mutual. Thank you.
But there's this myth that everyone seems to have that somehow a businessman is better, that somehow businesses operate more efficiently, more less corruptly than governments. And everything I've seen, General Motors, Halliburton, Pfizer, name all your big companies. They operate like Soviet Russia. They're all top down. Whereas democracy, at least nominally in this country, is supposedly a bottom up process. But they're just as bureaucratic. They're just as inefficient, if not more so, and they're less accountable. Like stock, I own stock in several companies, but I have no say over who the CEO is. I have little say over who the directors who pick the CEO is. And yet these guys, people have this idea that these guys can march into government and turn it into this well-oiled machine. And where does this myth come from? And why do people believe it?
Well, yeah, you make a very good point, which I mentioned earlier, that there is this very strong myth. I think it really goes back to the American psyche. You know, you look at the history of this country from the beginning, the founders the American colonies were founded in a very entrepreneurial way, and that it invited ambitious people to come and join them, as compared to, say, the Latin American colonies, Spain, the royal royal family really was the entrepreneurs there. It was like a giant plantation. I think this is the roots of the that basic fundamental American spirit for innovation, individual achievement, and glorifying the notion of upward mobility, the dream of upward mobility, which is wonderful. Getting back to Dr. King, you know, he said his dream was as old as the American dream. He connected the dream of equal opportunity to the great American dream. The problem these days, you look at statistics, and sadly, since 1980, it's become more and more difficult for a kid from a working-class family like I was to move up the ladder. And statistically, we are now falling behind European countries, falling behind the more advanced European countries in the ability of folks from the lower income bracket to work their way up to the top. We're just now starting to pay some attention to that in this campaign. And I think that without destroying the American dream of ambition and achievement and individual rights and respect, without destroying that dream, we need to enhance it. We need to make it work for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Bill, so much for the call. Well, Clarence, thank you so much. It's always a great pleasure to have you on the air.
It's a delight to be with you, and you let a pundit really finish his thoughts, which is a luxury. Thank you. It's a great privilege.
Well, you're entirely welcome anytime. The invitation is extended always. Clarence Page, op-ed columnist, Tribune Media Services, member of the editorial board of the Chicago Tribune, and Pulitzer Prize winner for commentary in 1989. He's also author of Showing My Color, Impolite Essays on Race and Identity. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. A reminder on this Martin Luther King Day, a special tribute to his life at our state capitol beginning at noon, and we will be broadcasting that here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay with us. We're going to be talking about service, the day of service, in just a few moments here on Wisconsin Public Radio.